I would briefly summarize what we wrote in the first article, like in the introduction of our current magazine, about surveillance. And I would like to explain how refugees are under surveillance with their smartphone, because I find it a good example, because smartphones are quite important for all of us, but for refugees, people on the move, of course, much more, because it's the only way to have contact with their relatives and friends, and also to inform themselves on their way how to get to the place where they seek shelter. And smartphones are under surveillance on the whole track. And for example, smartphones are being used to predict migration flows. This is not my word. But you can also, like the UNHCR, the refugee agency, is using it to monitor anonymously. So it's not about intercepting them. But the providers of the telephones, they give the data. So which telephones with which country code are operating from which area. And then you can see, like, there is a move, for example. Or websites like LinkedIn, if people change their status, that they have been living in Rwanda and now they're living in Kenya. So all these, you can call it open source intelligence or social media intelligence, all this data is being used to predict migration. And in terms of the UNHCR, this might make sense. But there are also projects to use it for Frontex, because Frontex wants to be prepared of people that might be on the way to Europe. And then if the people are on the sea, in the boats, so Frontex has drones and planes, and they have devices on board to locate mobile phones, basically satellite phones, because mobile phones do not work on the high seas. But if the people carry a satellite boat, that, which is mostly the case, if they are not leaving from Tunisia, where they are forbidden, Frontex can locate the boats, which is of importance, because in the night you cannot see, but you can instead locate the telephone. And I guess all of you are aware of the shipwreck in Cotonou in end of February, when Frontex drone or plane, I don't remember very well, located the boat by detecting the satellite phones, but not with the device in the beginning carried by the drone, but by satellites. And now the satellite technology with the Elon Musk mini satellites is much more advanced, like it was before. And so also satellites can detect mobile phones, satellite phones. And Frontex is using this technology since 2021. And if the people reach Europe, so you might know the stories on the so-called Balkan route where the phones are seized, destroyed, for example. And also there's the police agency Europol, which is something like Frontex, but for criminal police. EU agency, and they are taking down internet content of so-called smugglers. So many people that are on the move and they don't know how to get to Europe, they have to pay people to help them. And these Facebook groups where you can find these kind of helpers are being taken down by Europol, so people cannot inform themselves by their mobile on how they can get through the Balkan, for example. And if they then reach, let's say, Germany, the phones are confiscated at the border by the Bundespolizei, the federal police, to extract the content and to find smugglers. So imagine if you have several telephones which 2 days ago were calling the same number, that might indicate that this person who was being called helped them. This is for the police to get after these people. The thing is that the telephones of the people on the move are confiscated, even if that they are not suspect. So they are seen as testimonies, testifying, and they have their mobile phone taken for a month. because of the technical capacities of the Bundespolizei, so they don't have enough capacities to extract all the data and to make use of it. And so the people, we tried it. So if a lawyer calls at the Bundespolizei, and I have here this woman, she has a mobile phone taken, what's up, and the next day she got it back. And also at the asylum authorities, which in Germany is the BAMF, the Bundesamt für Migration und Flüchtlinge, and the hearings, in many cases they also ask the people, so this is not confiscation, they ask the people, so would you be up to hand out your mobile phone? And they also do an extraction, and they check, for example, the geolocation of the photos. So probably you know that you can switch it off, that if you take a photo, it has a timestamp and a geolocation stamp. They look at the endings of the links they had been using on their browser, for example. So if the ending is, for example, Syrian, they always browse on Syrian websites, then they are probably not from Afghanistan, for example. And they use these indicators to check if what the people tell in the hearings is true. And I said it's voluntarily, so the people are not obliged to hand over their phones, but imagine, most people don't know what they have to or not, and they are scared of saying no, because otherwise this might hamper their asylum case, which is, by the way, the case. So if the people have a mobile phone and don't hand it over, it might be seen as not collaborating. So this is just an example of surveillance of people on the move, which I think you can easily tell on the mobile phone, which is of utmost importance for refugees. But this just as a short introduction. So now Petra will tell us more about the research she did. She published a lot about surveillance. She's now working on a book, which is also focusing on AI. I just wanted to say that we will record the lecture, and we will also record the Q&A afterwards. But don't worry, we will cut out the questions. So you will definitely not appear in the audio, and we will publish this later on our website of the CILIP. Did I forget something? Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks again. I'm a lawyer and an anthropologist by training, and as Matthias said, I've now spent basically almost 6 years looking at how new technologies are used to manage migration and control borders. And I find that a global comparative approach is very helpful to try and tease apart some of the ways that these technologies operate in specific contexts, but also to kind of zoom out and look at the broader ecosystem in which all of this operates. I'll also be showing some photos, so it's a little bit more interesting to look at than just my face. But I think it's also important to try and capture what some of these environments look like, because a lot of the borders that I've had the privilege to go to and visit, and the people that are moving through and meet them, there's a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. A lot of the border spaces are very beautiful when you think of the Sonora Desert, for example, or a variety of different maritime or land borders in Europe. But they're also very deadly spaces. And I would really like to start here. You know, we are talking about a global border regime that regularly harms and kills people. Just last week, there was a massive shipwreck off of the coast of Greece. We're talking about probably the biggest maritime disaster to date. And what I've seen time and again is, across these different contexts, these already violent border policies are sharpened through the use of a variety of technologies. So things like drones, surveillance, automated decision-making, AI. And, you know, these technologies push people into life-threatening terrain, they separate families, and importantly also exacerbate the kind of historical and systemic discrimination that is so inherent in the daily reality of people who are moving. And what I've seen time and again across these different contexts is that they also serve as testing grounds for new technologies, because they're places where very little regulation and oversight already exists when it comes to the laws and policies that are playing out. And so when you mix that with this kind of obsession almost with a frontier attitude where anything goes in terms of the kind of tech projects that are introduced, you really end up with this really high-risk laboratory. So when we're trying to understand these impacts, it's important again to kind of zoom out and look at the broader ecosystem in which projects that Matthias already mentioned, but also things like AI lie detectors or polygraph machines, again, drones, automated decision-making, visa triaging, all of this occurs in this environment that is increasingly replete with criminalization of migration and anti-migrant sentiments and this kind of growing rise of, just sharpening borders through these different technologies. For me, one of the areas that I was in a few years ago was the Sonora Corridor between US-Mexico, which is a place where currently, for example, the Border Force is piloting what's called the CBP1 app, which is essentially using facial recognition for the purposes of identification and to get people into the system with, of course, varying levels of success, if I can put it that way. But it's also one of the spaces where you can see a lot of the surveillance infrastructure firsthand, such as these AI-powered surveillance towers that sweep the Sonora corridor for people who are crossing. And interestingly enough, they're also an Israeli surveillance company, Elbit Systems. And it's a little bit, I'd be curious what you think about this, but I sometimes find in other contexts like the frontiers of Fortress Europe, unless you can get into some of the camps, which I have been able to do and I will show you in a little bit, sometimes it's very difficult to actually see the kind of embodied impact of what this technology is doing and what it feels like and how it is making people's journeys more difficult. But at the US-Mexico border, you can drive up and you can get super close to these towers and you can actually see what they're like. But I have to say, in one of the probably most surreal moments of my career to date, and I have had many, like many of us in this space, when my colleagues and I were there, the Department of Homeland Security announced that they are planning to roll out these so-called RoboDogs, a four-legged quadruped machine, military-grade piece of machinery. But again, the context here is really, really important. We're talking about people who perished making these journeys. People like Mr. Alvarado, who was a young husband and father from Central America. We trekked for hours into the desert to visit his memorial site with a search and rescue group that took us there. And Mr. Alvarado, like many others, was in search of a better life, and he succumbed only kilometers away from a major highway. So again, this is the context where a lot of this surveillance technology is playing out. And often governments are using the rhetoric of deterrence or trying to prevent people from coming as a justification for this technology. But perhaps not surprisingly, surveillance and smart borders don't deter people from coming. If you're interested in this context, I would urge you to look at the work of Jeffrey Boyce and Samuel Chambers, for example, who've been tracking people's deaths in this area. Instead, what happens, people are forced to change their routes towards less inhabited terrain, leading to greater loss of life. And so it's quite disturbing to think that in the not-so-distant future, people like Mr. Alvarado might be pursued by high-speed military-grade technology like RoboDogs. I also always really like to put this picture up because to me it just encapsulates the absurdity of borders and the kind of social creation of walls. So this is of course the infamous Trump wall. You can drive up to it.
Can you see that it's something?
Exactly, it just stops basically. You can drive up to it, you can touch it, the rust will stay in your hand for the rest of the day. It's also painted black in parts to make it extra hot so that it burns people when they're trying to cross. But it also stops. And you can climb that hill and poke your head into Mexico. But of course, the US-Mexico frontier isn't the only space, and I want to preface this next photo by saying that I know it's a bit difficult to look at. I should have also said our photo policy for myself and my colleagues in the project that we work on, we don't tend to show people's faces unless they're direct participants in the work. That's done deliberately because so much of the visual imagery in this space is what some people have very rightly called poverty porn.
capturing people at their worst and then plastering it over, you know, UN reports and social media and everything, and it's just very dehumanizing, and we just don't do that. So a lot of the photography that I take, and I'm by no means a professional photographer, but it's to try and get at the essence of what the spaces feel like. So this is one of those spaces. Since about 2020, I've been in and out of various frontiers around Europe trying to get a sense of what this kind of regime feels like there. And one of the areas of great concern is the Evros region, the land border between Turkey and Greece. And almost as a pilgrimage in the region, there's this small village of Sidero that you can drive to. It's really beautiful. It's flanked by golden trees, and outside the small village lies a cemetery of unmarked graves, a resting place for those who've perished making the journey into Europe. Most of the graves are not marked, but some have inscriptions that were sent to the imam of the village by the families of those who passed. And when I was there, I touched the fresh grave on a memorial site for a young woman who died just 8 months before our visit there. She was born in 1993 from Syria, and there were still decayed roses on top of her grave. But when I was kind of kneeling down, paying my respects, I noticed something out of the corner of my eye, these three holes that were kind of gnawed crudely out of the earth, three open graves await. So again, this is the region where a lot of experimental new surveillance technology is being deployed. Some of which Matthias mentioned, like a lot of the aerial surveillance, the aerostat machines, drones. Frontex is very present there as well. We're also talking about, you know, an extension of the border wall, rolling out more experimental tools like sound cannons or long-range acoustic devices. All the while, these deaths happen, both at the land border as well as at the maritime border. The last kind of area I want to share with you, as a Frontex boat that I was not supposed to take a picture of, but anyways. The last area that I want to share with you is the kind of carceral element to all of this, and the fact that we are seeing this rise of these prison-like refugee camps that Greece has been piloting along the Aegean islands that separate Greece and Turkey. Kos camp, which is the one you're seeing here, is also, interestingly enough, the site of an EU-funded project called Row Border. I just love the names of these projects also. Row Border, Eye Border Control, Avatar, all sorts of things. But Row Border, and this is a direct quote, aims to create a fully functional autonomous border surveillance system with unmanned mobile robots, including aerial, water surface, underwater, and ground vehicles. But I would urge you to think about where these resources would be better spent instead of on surveillance technologies. I was also on the island of Samos. That was the first camp out of these five major centers that are opening. And this one opened in September 2021, so nearly 2 years ago. And again, replete with all sorts of high-tech interventions, like algorithmic motion detection, risk surveillance, fingerprint scanning, even virtual reality glasses for the guards to wear. But 2 weeks before opening, this camp didn't have running water. And I met a young mom there. She was pushing her little daughter in a stroller, and essentially she was facing what you could call a forcible transfer into one of these camps. And I was trying to get a sense of what she was feeling, and she quickly typed out this message, and it says, "If we go there, we will go crazy." Because this is what it looks like. It's far away from doctors, it's far away from lawyers, far away even from a place where you can take your children for a walk by the sea. So these, again, these experiments are being carried out on people who are inside these camps. And this is one of the biometric gates at the door. I don't want to get too much into the human rights discussion. Should we have time? Okay. I don't want to belabor the point, but I think it's pretty obvious that there is, from a legal perspective, I'll take my anthropology hat off and put my lawyer hat on, there is profound impacts when we're looking at the way that these technologies are playing out, right? We're talking about freedom of association, expression, religion, when we're starting to crack into people's phones and monitor social media. Obviously, freedom of movement and these established principles of international refugee law, like non-refoulement, which is basically the foundational idea that you're not allowed to return somebody to a place where they might be facing persecution. and of course life, liberty, security of the person if we're putting people into these carceral settings or even facilitating pushbacks through increasingly digital dragnets. Not to mention privacy rights and data protection issues, right? We're talking about communities that have historically been made marginalized and whose data is very sensitive. And we have international organizations also collecting vast amounts of data, and they've gotten in trouble for this too. For example, a few years ago, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was apparently inadvertently, according to them, sharing data of Rohingya refugees with the Myanmar government. Equality and freedom from discrimination, really, these kind of ideas underpin the violence in this system. We're talking about technologies that are very discriminatory and also operating in a system that's replete with systemic discrimination and racist undertones. So these are all, you know, we need to look at it from a holistic perspective, because when we start developing and deploying this technology without having some sort of framework in place, both in terms of transparency, but also from some sort of legal standard, and I'll get to that in a second, we really are talking about this kind of free-for-all where techno-solutionism, or this idea that somehow we can use technology to solve complex problems, this kind of tech-bro mentality, it really, really takes hold. I don't take up too much of your time, so I want to kind of just broaden it out to some of these broader ideas that concern me, because really, the technology is very important, but to me, the tech is a lens through which to understand these vast power differentials that exist in the way that projects are put forward, developed, normalized, and then deployed and tested. When and why have we decided that it's appropriate to use robodogs or facial recognition or drones at the border? I feel like we've like skipped a few parts of the conversation as a society that we need to have. Not to mention, like, for those of you who are interested in the legal bit, it really obfuscates accountability and responsibility. Like, let's say that you're wrongfully deported as a result of an algorithm. There's a real case. So 7,000 students got deported from the UK because an algorithm accused them of cheating on a language acquisition test. So let's say you're one of these students and you want to challenge this. Who's liable? Is it the designer of the algorithm, the person who codes it? Is it the immigration officer who uses it? Is it the algorithm itself? Should algorithms have legal personality in a court of law? I don't know. I don't have answers to these questions, but I think it's important that we pose them because it's really changing the way that just public administration is happening. And if I really had to sum up the last 6 years of my work, I think it's this. The fact that there is very little accountability, very little transparency, and virtually no governance mechanisms in place, that's not an accident. That is a deliberate choice where powerful actors get to say, we want to experiment in these areas on these people versus others. Imagine if, I don't know, robodogs started running around local streets here, or you had to give your biometrics to go to your grocery store, or you had to take an AI lie detector to see your doctor. People would be up in arms. But somehow we are okay with it when it happens at the border. I do want to show you, formatting's a bit off, but it is bleeding away from the edges of the border.
Perhaps explain the picture.
Oh, yes. So this, I know it's a bit hard to see, but basically in May, the New York City Police Department proudly announced that they are too going to be using robodogs for law enforcement purposes. One of them is even painted like a Dalmatian with spots on it. Very cute. That's part of the question. I mean, they're supposed to technically assist the police force with determinations in terms of risk assessments. They were also used in Honolulu, for example, in Hawaii during COVID, running around the streets
and
with cameras, exactly, trying to determine if people who are houseless were a threat in the global pandemic. That was stopped due to public outcry, but somehow they are now back in New York. So again, I just bring this up because the border is important to pay attention to, and for me as a refugee lawyer and a border researcher, that's my kind of, you know, my area. But again, it's not just there anymore. When we normalize it at the edges, it then also percolates throughout the rest of society. And yeah, I mean, maybe I will leave it here, but I just want to say it's ultimately, I mean, it's about the tech, but actually it's about power, right? It's about who gets to determine what we innovate on and why. And there's this huge piece to this, too, that I know Matthias is also really interested in, and that's the role of the private sector in all of this. Private companies are the ones who are the major drivers, both normatively, like in terms of what we innovate. For example, why are we developing robo-dogs and AI lie detectors and sound cannons when we could be using AI to root out racism at the border? Like that's a clear choice, right? There's a powerful actor that says, these are the tools that we're going to sell to the government. And it's about, yeah, just this vast power differential between those who are kind of the testing grounds and where these spaces become just like a free-for-all for tech development. So I normally end there, but I do have some positives that I want to share with you, but maybe we'll get to those later.
Let's do the positives later at the end, so we will keep that. Thank you for the moment. As you can imagine, I have some questions, and you probably as well. So I would like to focus a bit more. You mentioned biometrics in half a sentence. So can you tell a bit more about the role of using of facial images and fingerprints in migration control? I don't know, perhaps the European examples or the databases?
Sure, yeah, biometrics.
Biometrics
are, yeah, it's a very important area to focus on, both in terms of the way that it's very, I think it's probably one of the most visceral examples because it's like literally the body becomes the border. Whether we're talking about face recognition or fingerprinting or iris scanning, and, you know, it seems kind of innocuous. It's like, oh, well, it's just for ID purposes or it's just to create, you know, a bigger database that either immigration enforcement or sometimes law enforcement has access to, because of course there's also very few firewalls that exist between the data that's collected for immigration purposes versus law enforcement. But again, when you actually talk to people, the ones that have to give their fingerprints or iris scans or biometrics, many of the folks that I've spoken with and have gotten to know over the years talk about the kind of violation and this kind of, again, this embodied nature of surveillance that is felt. People even burn off their fingerprints, for example, because there's an act of resistance to try and not be part of these databases. And for me also, what's interesting, again, just to bring it back to the role of international organizations in all of this, the normalization of biometrics does also come from that sector. And partly, you know, I do understand, as someone who has been to context of, you know, humanitarian emergency in various settings, it's a very complicated place to distribute aid, to distribute resources. So, of course, we need to think about, like, how do we make sure that the things are done in a way that makes sense? But why is the answer always more data, more technology? Again, if we actually slow down and spend time talking with people, I remember I spoke with one gentleman from Syria, and I have his permission to share. It seems, you know, sometimes when we say, oh, it's just an iris scan, maybe for you and I, for someone who survived torture in an Assad prison, it might actually remind him of some of the similar things that he went through there. Again, when you talk to the designers of this technology or the implementers, even people at the UN, it's almost like we've dehumanized the people who are moving so much that we don't actually even think through what this technology is doing. Not to mention, there's this whole other element where so much of these data sets really form the kind of underpinning to a lot of the other technological development that happens. And it's, again, this kind of idea that more data is always better. We must have more, more, more. It's almost data colonialism, some people have called it, this extraction. And there is something uniquely disturbing, I think, about the biometric element, like the fact that it's our bodies, you know, that there's something visceral about that I think we need to really pay attention to, because, again, it's often relegated to spaces of exception and spaces of discretion, like the border.
I think you would agree to the conclusion that many of these things on biometrics are being tested and experimented on migrants, asylum seekers. So, for example, on a European level, this is where I have a bit knowledge about. The fingerprinting database for asylum seekers was created in 2003 and then enhanced with facial images. The visa applicants have to give their biometric data since, I think, 2011. And now the EU is introducing a new system for all the rest. So even the visa-free travelers that come to the EU have to give their fingerprints. And I think you can explain this also in many other examples when surveillance technology is being used first against people on the move and then are being introduced into other domestic surveillance stuff. You wrote a lot about AI, but you didn't talk about it. So what is the AI aspect on these surveillance technologies? I mean, of course, all the digital surveillance could be enhanced by AI, but is there something special, like a disruption you see with the use of AI in border technologies?
That's a really, really good question, because I think with AI, it's kind of this term in vogue, and I definitely use it strategically in my work, sometimes to get the attention of policymakers or people who are learning about these topics. But I think it's also, and I myself have become much more critical of some of these framings as well, because I feel like there's this like AI hype, and oftentimes, you know, like it is AI, but also at the same time, it's all sorts of other things. It's biometrics, it's machine learning, it's all sorts of other kind of facets to it. But I will say again, the kind of automation of very, very complex applications or decisions, that's where the problem really lies. Because again, when we think about what's the context that we're really talking about, right? We're talking about decision making, whether you're looking at immigration or refugee or border. It's a very opaque, very discretionary system already when humans make decisions, right? You can have two officers look at the exact same set of evidence and render two completely different yet equally legally valid decisions. That's just humans. So when we start augmenting either partially or fully some of this decision making by algorithms or machine learning or AI or whatever you want to call it, it again obfuscates responsibility, accountability, and even just our own understanding of how these decisions are made. For me, one of the really, really visceral examples is this kind of proliferation of largely pilot projects where people are trying to say, oh, we're going to build an AI lie detector or polygraph machine for the purposes of border enforcement.
Which has been developed for testing for the moment, but this kind of lie detector for travelers.
Exactly. So another interesting name for project, iBorder Control. So you have your iPad, your iPhone, and your iBorder Control. Funded by Horizon 2020 also, the European funding scheme. Purported to basically put together an AI lie detector or a polygraph machine based on facial recognition and micro expression analysis and roll it out in Greece, Hungary, and Latvia. Greece and Hungary, kind of obvious because they're major interdiction points. Latvia, I'm not really sure why that was there, but anyways. But again, I mean, we could spend an entire seminar on talking about whether this technology works, what it's doing, how it's doing it. But from a refugee law perspective, or perhaps just the human perspective, like, how can an AI lie detector deal with the complexities of human communication, like cross-cultural communication, for example? I've represented people and worked with people who don't make eye contact with decision makers of the opposite gender due to religion, due to experience, or maybe because they're nervous. Or what about the impact of trauma on memory and the fact that we don't tell stories in a linear way anyway? Like, humans struggle with this. One of my colleagues in Toronto, Hilary Evans Cameron, has done amazing work on this. If you're interested in the kind of intersection between credibility and decision making, I would urge you to look up her work. But again, we know that humans struggle with this. So once we start augmenting or replacing, even in just the life cycle of decision making with some sort of automation, it's a big problem. And often, I don't know, maybe you get this as well, when you start critiquing it, governments will say, oh, but don't worry, there's a human in the loop. Like, someone's going to check it at the end. Even though we know that there's automation bias, that people have this proclivity to say, oh, well, if a machine renders something, it's more likely than not to be more accurate than if a human officer does it. So again, I think AI is perhaps exacerbating a lot of the issues that are already inherent in this space. Not to mention, again, this kind of AI hype and techno-solutionism. And now also this like really strange conversation that's being had by a lot of the tech bros, right, who are like, no, okay, we gotta like stay the course on AI, and Geoffrey Hinton having an about face. I don't know if you've been following this, one of the kind of forefathers of AI, even though he's been kind of pushing this for decades, all of a sudden maybe he's having some sort of end of life reckoning. I don't know, I mean, you can tell that I'm a bit critical of these kind of moves, but it's an interesting area to pay attention to. Not to mention, we also haven't talked much about the regulation bit, but for those of you who are interested in that, the European Union, of course, is undergoing a massive attempt to put together a set of laws to regulate AI. So the AI Act has been under discussion for over 2 years now. And it's still in discussion. It's going to the trilogues, and then it will become law. And it's a huge, 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 gargantuan project. And really the first regional attempt to try and regulate something as amorphous as artificial intelligence. But perhaps you won't be surprised that border technology once again has been relegated to the sidelines. And there was a coalition of us, some academics, some lawyers, some civil society. We were trying to push for nearly a year and a half to get the members of European Parliament to strike some red lines under certain uses of technology, such as predictive analytics used for border enforcement or pushbacks, individualized risk assessments, and a few others. And unfortunately, last week, it didn't pass. Again, migration is extremely political. Technology is very political. And when you have that intersection, I have unfortunately lost a bit of hope in terms of what we can do to regulate this. That was a very roundabout answer to your question.
That's exactly what I wanted to know. You also spoke about the corporates that are behind this technology, but if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned only one, Elbit Systems, who is a drone producer from Israel. So there's another one, IAI, who is operating drones since more than 20 years over Gaza, and also operating, or the Bundeswehr, the German armed forces, or Luftwaffe area forces, is using also drones from IAI, and the same drones are operated by Frontex. Basically, not Frontex is flying them, and not IAI, but Airbus. The Airbus company in Bremen is flying the drones for Frontex, and the drones are coming from Israel. But there are other companies, like on databases or sensor technology. Could you name just some, or explain just some?
Sure.
The big players?
Yeah, and thanks for bringing that up, actually, because my colleague, Florian Schmitz, who's a journalist, and I, we were actually in Palestine in February in the occupied West Bank to see precisely this, to see the way that Israeli technology, military grade, is tested out there and then sold off for entities like Frontex and others. But of course, that's just one area. I mean, there's major, major players. Cellebrite is another one, also an Israeli company. But it's really fascinating when you start picking apart all the players. You have Thales, Airbus, the big ones. But then there's also this ecosystem of smaller players and companies that are somehow able to kind of scoot under the radar. I don't know if you've gone to any of these conferences, like the World Border Security Congress
that
or anything.
That would have been my next question, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, so these are these kind of, I mean, talk about dystopic, right? Like, you walk into this massive hall, and it's like tanks and drones and rubber dogs and thermal cameras that are being sold like toys. I don't mean to be disparaging, but there's something really disturbing about, again, this kind of almost like a tech bro culture, techno solutionism. Is like, don't worry, we got you. Here's this like toy that you can use at the border that actually kills people. It's very, very disturbing, and so much of it is, I mean, all of it really is underpinned by private sector interests. Because it's lucrative. There's a huge border industrial complex that has grown up around the use of this technology. And trying to pay attention to the smaller players is quite tricky because a lot of them are able to kind of scoot under the radar. Now, you do a lot of work with procurement and all of that. I think in different jurisdictions, there's different expectation around also access to publicly available data. Oftentimes in places like Canada, we find out about it after the fact. For example, a journalist colleague of mine found out that Palantir Technologies, a very, very problematic company, was for a while the preferred vendor for the Canadian federal government. How did that happen, right? I think we need to pay attention to how money changes hands, especially in these public-private partnerships. But I'd be curious, you have to hear your perspective on this.
Palantir is a company selling platforms for predictive surveillance, merging data, for police and also other purposes. So we here in Berlin, we have this annual, they call it European Police Conference, but conference, it's basically a fair. They have many talks. They invite the companies. They can act as sponsors. And sometimes they had like platinum, gold, silver sponsors. And the more money you pay, the more you can talk. And they sit together with politicians and practitioners or practitioners, which means police and all the three different bodies. So, for example, the police are sitting there and saying, like, yeah, we have really problems at the borders because it happens very often that the people, the smugglers with their cars, they drive away and we have really difficulties to catch them. And then it's like, ah, look, we have this ray cannon, this, what is the English word, like, Strahlenkanone, where you can, with HPIM technology, EM technology, you can switch off the motor from far away. And then there are some politicians, they are like, oh, that's what we need, and they bring it up into the next meeting of the Home Office Committee. And this is what these conferences are for, like creating the desire, or let's say, yeah, creating the desire to cope with, let's say, for example, migration with technical means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and exactly. And the word cope is really key. I mean, it's the logic that underpins it is that migration is a problem and we have the solution through these increasingly sharper tools. And it's really disturbing to see because, again, and I don't mean to harp on about this legal governance mechanism. I mean, you know this. I'm a reluctant lawyer at best. I think the law is very problematic in many ways. But it's also interesting to see that it just there is this gap there. And these power actors are able to do this because there's virtually very little governance and regulation in place to say, we probably shouldn't be selling and normalizing tools like this for the government. I mean, it's all bound up again in this kind of for-profit logic that unfortunately animates a lot of the kind of border and the militarization industrial complex that have now become conflated. I mean, all these kind of conferences, like the one you're mentioning, or the World Border Security Congress, or DEFEA, or blanking on the name of the U.S. one, it was just, I think, in Arizona. It's literally they take like border enforcement and military stuff together. It's like in the messaging, the imagery, it's just there. It's you can't even really critique it. It's very, very obvious, the kind of discourse that's being pushed.
Okay, so do you also have any questions, comment? We can now open it up. There's a microphone that somebody, I don't know who, will carry around. And please leave the positive aspects for later. So now we want to have the dystopic part.
Comparison? Okay, sorry, I'm taking notes because I will also forget. So your question about the kind of ecosystem and the actors that are present from the kind of private sector or also, like you say, the think tanks that are put together, it makes me think, and I'm very horrible with acronyms, but just last week there was a really interesting story on Coda Story that does like fascinating reporting on tech and human rights about a pan-European think tank, the International... I'll look this up, it's on my phone. Do you know what I'm talking about? They're the ones that are... They present themselves as very kind of academic, very nonpartisan or whatever, but actually they've been normalizing and funding technology that's used for border externalization.
The ICMP.
Yeah. We haven't talked much about externalization, but that's the phenomenon of using technology to push the border further away and disaggregate it from its physical location and kind of... extended either horizontally or vertically into the sky or you know, into, let's say, North Africa and even beyond. And the ICMP has, been basically proven to be normalizing and funding a lot of this tech. But I think your point also goes to the fact that, again, it's about power and who gets to have the kind of decision-making clout in these spaces. When we have massive corporations and companies like Meta/Facebook or Twitter going to Brussels and lobbying policymakers, that's a huge problem. when civil society groups and people with lived experience don't get access into these spaces. Again, there's a huge power differential there.
Can I stick
with that? Yeah, of course, yeah.
The ICMPD, which is an abbreviation for the National Center for Migration Policy and Development, I think. Many Germans will know it because there is a comedian, Jan Böhmermann, who has a weekly session. And I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, he had his show about the ICMPD. And he explained a bit their work, but what he was lacking was the technology aspect, actually. And the ICMPD is an intergovernmental body, so it's not a governmental body, so you cannot hold them accountable as a government, but governments can be member. And what they do is working in the so-called third state, so they are not operating in the EU, so their task is like working in Bosnia, working in Tunisia, working in Bangladesh, and also they are supporting the Tunisian Coast Guard, for example. And everybody of us know how important the Tunisian Coast Guard is at the moment to stop people crossing the Mediterranean with technology. And about the actors, there is something very interesting. I don't know if you are aware, the European Research Program. So they do research on everything, climate, environment, fishing, but also security. And there was a research that a colleague of us from Zürich, Erik Töpfer, did in around 2005. The program at that time, they always were for 7 years. They have these 7 years program. And when they were figuring out the next 7 year program, they created a steering board, to think about what should be in the program, which things should be investigated. And there were, if I'm not mistaken, 10 members. And imagine who they were. They were like ERDS, which is now Airbus. There was Thales. There were some database companies that I don't really remember well. It might be Atos. And the German BKA was inside. So that didn't happen again. So we were like, for the next 7 year program, we were like, okay, who's in the steering board? But they changed how it works. But it's a bit like that. There are some, let's say, masterminds that sit together on conferences or meetings and make the plans. And of course, all these big players, so there had been great research by groups like Statewatch or the TNI, which document how many companies are in which projects. Basically, there are people in the room that know more about it, but I don't want to point at them now. If you want, you can tell. That's what I... And then there was the other question.
I just want to pick up on one more thing that your question made me think of, though, and it's perhaps an obvious point, but it's one I would like to make. It's the idea of, what does risk even mean, right? And what does security even mean? We kind of throw around these terms, right? And we mean governments. like powerful actors. You know, we are obsessed with risk and fraud and security, but risky for who? Secure for who? And even like tech for good for who? We have to really query these really basic ideas, because obviously, again, I don't need to come back to this point, but it is always the powerful actors that get to say, you are the risky ones, you are the controllable ones, we must make sure that you're intelligible, and how do we do that? Through more technology. And then your question about the kind of comparisons or similarities between China, US, and Europe. I mean, one thing that China, I think, blows the other contexts out of the water for is scale. I mean, we're talking about a huge infrastructure of surveillance and normalized surveillance in daily life, but also in these really specific, very sharp ways against the Uyghur population, for example. And then these carceral camps and centers that are not only used as, again, like the ultimate testing ground for this technology, but also as a way to normalize it for the broader population. But I think your question perhaps also points to the importance of geopolitics, and we're going to have to see, you know, how technology development, or the so-called AI arms race, sometimes people call it, how that's going to go, especially if the EU AI Act is going to be kind of watered down and weaker, and You know, what will that do geopolitically? It could have set a standard and a precedent for a strong governance mechanism. Whether it will, I think that's still an open question.
So the question about U.S. technology, Chinese technology, so I don't like this narrative that is being posed by, for example, also the German government now that they want to use less Chinese technology. There are also some media outlets like Die Welt, for example, who are really campaigning against Chinese drones. And the drones, I'm talking about the small ones that some of us have at home for fun or for making films or whatever. And these drones are also used by the police. And it's a massive market now. And I think behind this that they want to sell German drones. Because the argument is, well, the Chinese government, it's very sensitive. They might have access to the images that the drones are taking. Come on, what are these drones filming? It's not Secret Service. They are used for documenting car crashes by the police, for example. Or they are monitoring areas where a murder happened, something like this. I'm definitely sure that the Chinese government is not interested in that. So it's just a camera. And the camera is flying outside and it's not covering something secret that the Chinese government needs to know. But all the German forces are now buying drones in a massive scale. There's a technology shift now. And all the old drones that were very large, heavy, expensive, are being replaced now by small ones. And it's a market, in my opinion. And there was this hacking question. So
should we move to the
solution? Perhaps we leave this for later. But I mean, we can talk about the bad guys. So there's also... Of course, databases that are collecting data from migrants can be hacked. And this had happened, for example, for the Schengen Information System. This is about already 10 years ago or something, when the Danish national system, so the Schengen Information System is the biggest police database in Europe. It's mainly used for migration purposes, because everybody who has his asylum case rejected is being placed there for deportation or for refusal of re-entry. And this database was hacked by pirate, like, I think it was an alternative. So the person didn't do it for making money. It was a bit for showing how weak the system is. But it happened, so they leaked data.
Not to mention the other area too is the kind of weaponization of, you know, people who actually do work to assist people who are on the move. So, you know, criminalizing search and rescue, hacking into journalists and you know, human rights monitors' phones, smear campaigns on social media. Even just recently, I think there was an access to information request that found out that Europol had designated Abolish Frontex and a bunch of other, you know, quote-unquote lefty groups, probably half of us in this room, as people of interest. And did you see this?
Networks.
Yeah.
So they were named. So Europol is giving out an annual terrorism trend report, that's their name. And under the headline of left-wing terrorism, at the end there was a section about networks. And they mentioned the Noboda camp in Rotterdam. And they mentioned the Abolish Frontex campaign. So we are definitely kicking their ass.
Oh, yeah,
so,
definitely.
I was something more. Yes, of course. We were talking about technology against migration and people on the move, but also against... it's also used for people who help them. So, for example, it came out that on the Juventus ship, one of the rescue ships that is operated from Germany, and the people on the ship were bugged, so they were intercepted on the ship, and obviously the police had also been using Trojans on their phones to get information, so to intercept their phones. And this is why I definitely advise everybody who's doing this kind of sensitive and important work to have their phones checked. There are some organizations that offer this. So if you think you might need it. For example, you can get contact via the Cars Computer Club, or we can also give you advice later if you need it. So there have been at least one more question, and I'm sure there are. So there in the back, you, and there in the back as well, and then you. Yeah, so about the databases, so it's definitely not possible that one country opens its database to another country except you have a publicly known contract. Of course, they share data, so Secret Services is doing that all day. This is what they are for. They receive data, information and data, and they give data. But this is hidden. But I think you are more talking about, for example, migration data. So is, for example, Italy able to access Senegalese biometric databases for compare fingerprints? And on a police level, this is definitely not happening because data is also something that every country knows. It's sensitive. And imagine a government that is known to give your data to another country for at least they will not survive the next elections or will be turned down even earlier. But this data exchange is happening on another way. For example, all the European countries, they have common databases, and they try to build up databases in other countries or regions that might connect. For example, you have Balkan countries that are EU candidates, and they get lots of money for preparing this pre-accession aid. And one of it is, for example, to build up a BalkanDuck database. So I don't know if you remember, we talked about the EuroDuck database, which is a European data fingerprinting facial images of asylum seekers, and the idea is now that the countries that might be in the European Union in decades, Bosnia, Serbia, that they have the same kind of database, probably by the same manufacturers, like the same companies, that are compatible, and in future they can be merged. So if they are an EU member, they can be merged, but the data can be used before. So with the new GS, the European Asylum and Migration Reform, so-called reform, the idea is that third states become much more important, so neighboring states, for pushing the people back. And for this you need databases. You need to know, did the people leave their fingerprints already in Bosnia on whatever, at the border authorities? And then you can compare these databases. But for now, they are not connected, and mostly this is done by, they call it liaison officers, so Verbindungsbeamter. So, and these people sit together, like Croatian and Bosnian, and they have access to their national databases, but they can talk, like, look, we have this or that person, does it appear in your database? So this kind of data sharing happens very much, but it's, in my understanding, not happening on a police scale that one country has a direct access. I mean, there are exceptions. There is now a treaty being made under discussion between European countries and the US for border purposes. But this is then, this is a public treaty and it's vice versa. So the idea is that German police can access US migration data and the other way around.
Okay, so many great questions. The one about Horizon 2020, great point, I mean, in terms of scalability of funding and all of that. But I think what's quite disturbing about Horizon 2020 is that it is kind of seen almost as this like, oh, it's just a pilot project, therefore don't worry so much about it, let's not critique it to the same level as other things. And also, we haven't really talked much about academia, and as someone who kind of sits on in the practical academic nexus, I think it's important to call it out because a lot of academics participate in Horizon 2020 and normalize what's happening under this kind of veneer of objectivity and like the scientific rigor or whatever. Like the AI lie detector we were talking about, eye border control, Manchester University was one of the partners in that project. I think it's important, again, to pick apart who actually is involved in this and what it's doing from the kind of normative perspective. The question about the lack of scandal and the kind of normalization again of this kind of violence. Yeah, I don't know. This is something that keeps me up at night a lot. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, we are living in a world with competing crises, and the way that life has become difficult for many people, again, is perhaps deliberate, because it keeps us all focused inward and not actually able to relate to one another, particularly in areas like migration and borders that I think are already, for the average person, very far away from their mind. I mean, you all chose to come here on Monday. You know, you're obviously very interested in these topics, but I sometimes catch myself too as like we have this predisposition towards being in a bit of an echo chamber, because we do talk to one another and we all get incensed and it's like really terrible. But I actually have to think that most of society is very removed from this. So like, what do we do about that? What do we do about the lack of scandal around this? And a lot of it is also, I don't want to make it too theoretical, but it is about this kind of biopower of the state, or what, you know, sometimes is referred to as necropolitics. Achille Mbembe talks about this a lot. This kind of idea that certain people are less worthy of life than others. It's just normalized through these practices. And when somebody sees the 30th headline of yet another shipwreck on the news, like, people just skip over it. Again, we're dealing with COVID after effects. We're dealing with environment. We're dealing with the economy. I think most people are just so not able to tap into what is really going on, and that's probably also deliberate. And then the last question about the AI Act. I really appreciate that question. I think it's a bit, maybe it's too early to tell what exactly will happen. I think some of my colleagues are a little bit more optimistic. I'm like a diehard optimist. I don't know. I think I've lost it this year. I think all the stuff that's happening, it just doesn't give me a lot of hope. There's still a small sliver that during the trilogue, perhaps certain things could still be put on the table. But again, when you zoom out and you look at the kind of politics around migration topics, I'm not really seeing it on the kind of border tech scale. But it was interesting because, yeah, we went through this whole process with this coalition trying to see, like, how far can we actually push this thing? And you know, a year ago, even trying to get people to talk about predictive analytics used for pushbacks, like, they're like, wow, first of all, what is that? And second of all, no member of parliament is going to care about that. But turns out that was one of the things that a lot of MEPs actually were, like, really incensed about and wanted to do something about. There was, you know, a coalition of German MEPs that came to Greece, for example, to learn about the situation last year. So, I don't know, we can get discouraged a lot in these situations, but there is something to be said too about just putting something on the public record and trying to kind of get it out there. Even though it didn't pass, I think it is still powerful in that kind of archival perspective, that maybe next time there'll be a little bit of a path that's already been paved by this previous process.
I mean, we have here in Germany a very big movement of migration solidarity and really movements. I mean, remember how strong the demonstrations of Seebrücke were at a certain time. We have certain associations running refugee, like SAR, sea rescue ships. But I also sometimes feel that I'm working for a magazine on police since many years, like police surveillance, and I'm also interested in border surveillance. But sometimes I would also wish a little bit more connection, like that these movements, these activists are also more interested in the technology aspect. On the other hand, when I get into discussion with these groups, I learned that why should we do this? Why is it important to know the name of the drone that Frontex is operating, or the company who is selling the sensor technology? Which is right. I mean, you don't need such a deep knowledge about the technology to know that these are your enemies. But you need to have a certain understanding, because also the technologies that are being used against migration will hit you in the next couple of years in a certain way. So I don't know, perhaps this is the moment, as we have like way more than an hour now, to switch to the positive aspects that we might see. I mean, we can discuss if this is really positive, because it's still surveillance technology. But if you don't mind, I can present the examples I have already. These are three examples I want to give. One is, for example, that there's a group called SearchWing. They are developing drones that are lightweight, they are cheap, they're easy to handle, flying them from refugee ships. Because, as you know, the Earth is not flat, and the higher you are on the sea, the more far you can look. And these drones might also patrol and watch out for refugee ships. This technology is not in daily use, but they test it since 2 years on refugee ships, and I heard that it already kind of helped them. So this is an idea to make use of this technology. The other thing is satellite surveillance. So it's not that these groups, Space Eye, I think it's, mm-hmm. is it Space Eye?
Yeah.
It's the association, the group. It's not that they have their own satellites, but there are satellite images publicly accessible. Or you can also buy satellite images, but this is also the boundary of the thing, because this is kind of expensive, so you need lots of money. But you can detect boats also on the sea, but also with limits, because satellites they don't give you the information in real time, so you cannot watch a boat like with a camera, for example. And it's also difficult to spot: is it a boat with refugees, or is it a fishing boat, or is it just whatever weird thing on the image? But people are working on that. And there's another thing from this project, Leave No One Behind. People that are programming an app, they call it Claim Asylum EU. It is still not out. I hope it will happen. The idea is to avoid or to counter pushbacks, like in Greece. So you might know that many people are being pushed back before they are able to claim their asylum. And the idea is to have an app connected to a secure server that you have like the code to access on a later stage if you want. And if you are in Greece, for example, you can make your asylum application on a digital way, which is legal. You can do it. You can do it on paper, you can do it also digitally. And then you make photos of your surroundings, you make selfies, you leave your geolocation, for example, to prove that you have been in Greece. Because this is of importance. If you are deported, then you can appeal against it. And it might raise the chance that you are able to enter the European Union. But this is also, it has some critical aspects, because first of all, you leave personal data on a server somewhere. But I think this can be solved. But the problem is the people probably don't want to have their asylum application in Greece, because they might want to have it in Germany or in France or in Sweden. But with the current regime, and also in future, the country where you have your asylum application, you are forced to stay there. And so it has this technology also has its shortcomings, but I find it very interesting to think about it.
Yeah, this is such a, I think, important conversation to end on, the kind of solutions. And for myself personally, you know, the majority of the things I've been doing is like pointing out all the problems and seeing all the sharp things and getting very, very depressed by the very depressing reality. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of really interesting resistance, contestation, and creativity happening in this space as well. Like some of the projects that Matthias mentioned, kind of almost like turning the technology that is currently in play on the powerful entities. It also makes me think of a colleague of mine, Professor Elspeth Gild. She was talking to me the other day about this interesting idea of like saying, okay, so Frontex is so proudly boasting of all the surveillance that they're doing, but conveniently, of course, turning it off when, you know, we would actually need to have access to it. But maybe there's a way to compel them to release it and kind of turning the surveillance that they have on themselves and using it for prosecutions, for example. If you're so proud of having all this tech, well, then the public should have access to it to actually see what is it that you're doing.
That's basically a demand I heard very often from sea rescue organizations. So the Mediterranean Sea is probably the best monitored, surveilled area or sea in the world, I don't know. And why do so many people drown? Why don't the authorities give this data for the rescuers? I mean, it's not that's not the future that I want, that protectors do the surveillance, give the data to us and we rescue the people, but at least less people would drown.
Yeah, so I think there's like the kind of short-term solutions of like perhaps using the world as it currently exists, but I think we can go beyond that and think creatively. I want to point out two examples. One is my colleague Sean Rehag. He's kind of the other half of the Refugee Law Lab that we have at York University. And his work is much more quantitative. Mine's the kind of qualitative, people-oriented stuff. But he's really been thinking in such innovative ways of trying to use, for example, big data analytics to assist refugee lawyers to better prepare them based on the different judges that they will get. So this judge, for example, has a proclivity towards being racist towards a particular group. Okay, so that will obviously inform how you structure your arguments. And even, you know, making different judicial decision-making publicly available. I think these tools can actually be very helpful because, again, oftentimes you have so much technology that's developed for governments and for government lawyers who are kind of on the other side of the refugee applicant, but not for the council that is representing and working with refugees themselves. But I do want to also share with you a project that we have going on at the Migration and Technology Monitor, because to me, this has been probably the most joyful and interesting kind of outcome of a lot of the work that I've been privileged to be able to do. So the Migration Tech Monitor is an archive and a platform in four languages, including Arabic, French, Spanish, and English. And it's meant to kind of pull together some of the work on these topics. But more recently, you know, one of the commitments that I've always had in my work is how do we actually meaningfully create participation with affected communities from the get-go, not as a tokenization, not as like, oh, you know, at the 11th hour of your project, you pluck someone from the community and you introduce them into your project or on a panel or anything like that. How do we actually decenter so-called global north narratives and the way that knowledge is produced and who counts as an expert? And one way to do that is to actually push resources into communities and let people do their own work on these issues. And so we started off, we started off our first very small fellowship program for five people on the move who are going to be doing their own work on surveillance and borders. And again, the starting point is they have the lived expertise and experience on this, and they should be in the driver's seat. So instead of funding 20 people, we are funding five with a living wage. And we have Veronica Martinez, Nair Santayala, Wael Kharsifi, Rajendra Paudel, and Simon Droti from Mexico, Venezuela, Syria, now in Nepal, now in Malaysia. Rajendra's in Nepal, and Simon's in Uganda. And they're all going to be doing really interesting, very different stuff, from original reporting on the CBP app from Mexico, to using WhatsApp as a way to communicate with refugees in Venezuela. Simon, for example, is creating a memory scroll, a psychosocial archive for displaced communities in Uganda. I know this is like a really small, kind of granular example, but it gives me a lot of hope to kind of really commit to these slower, deeper, grounded methodologies of really thinking through, like, how do we actually support people on the move to tell their own stories, to, I think, also act as a way to resist some of these huge power differentials that are so inherent in these spaces. I don't know, I really think community building is at the center of all of this. I mean, look at this community that came out on a Monday night, right? It's really easy to get depressed, I think, in this space because it's pretty bad out there. But for me, this has been such an amazing little sliver of how there is so much joy and resistance and creativity in this sharp space that, yeah, I think we all have to hold on to.
So then we will be here. We will definitely have a beer next door. Come with us or ask us after the lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It was great.
It's a pleasure.